This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the Holistic Survival Show with Jason Hartman. The economic storm brewing around the world is set to spill into all aspects of our lives. Are you prepared? Where are you going to turn for the critical life skills necessary to survive and prosper? The Holistic Survival Show is your family's insurance for a better life. Jason will teach you to think independently, to understand threats, and how to create the ultimate action plan. Sudden change or worst case scenario, you'll be ready. Welcome to Holistic Survival, your key resource for protecting the people, places, and profits you care about in uncertain times. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Jason Hartman.
It's my pleasure to welcome Brendan Ahern. He is the Chief Investment Officer of Crane Shares, and they specialize in China. So there's a lot to talk about with what's going on with China nowadays. We had a brewing trade negotiation, as I call it. Everybody wants to call it a trade war. I think it's a negotiation. And then, of course, we sadly had coronavirus. So a lot to talk about there. Brendan, welcome. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you, Jason. Thanks for having me on.
It's good to have you. So first, I'd like to talk about where is China now? Obviously, a lot of their factories were shut down. They're getting back into business. They have had some news of second waves of infections. What's the vibe on the China side right now?
So in mainland China, they are back to work 100%. I think countries in Asia have had to deal with similar pandemics in the past, if it's SARS or MERS or H1N1. And because of the strength of the quarantine in China, that they feel they've stamped it out. And mm-hmm. So people are back at work. People are traveling domestically again. And we're seeing, you know, from an economic perspective, a serious rebound happening. And I think it's not just China. You know, if you look at Vietnam, South Korea, Japan, Taiwan, you can see the strength of the quarantine. You know, Vietnam, 100 million people, under 400 cases of coronavirus.
Yeah, wow. Those are pretty strong numbers. And South Korea did a pretty good job, it seems like, with everything. You know, the way they handled it seemed like they were pretty successful. So you're saying China's back 100%. The supply chain has still got definitely some lag in it. We're all seeing that. I mean, I'm just seeing it as a consumer. You know, when I buy something online, a lot of stuff's not available. A lot of stuff's more expensive because of the lack of availability. And it's been pretty surprising. But what about the trust aspect? There's been some talk, I don't want to say it's a lot, but it's certainly out there that China can't be trusted on the world stage anymore. And other nations feel like they misled the world in terms of the numbers, the severity, et cetera. Now, we're going back a few months here from when those thoughts were developed, I guess. What are your thoughts about that? Is that fair or unfair to China?
I mean, I think it's easy to Monday morning quarterback things and say should have, would have, could have. I think that's true, you know, here in the United States, where I always kind of give people, you know, give our government a pass that, you know, we haven't had a pandemic here in 100 years. But when you hear that the head of the CDC spoke to the head of the CDC China on January 2nd, that, you know, people in, you know, very high levels of government knew by mid-January that this was a very serious situation. And they let me get on an airplane and fly into China at that time period, you know, knowing that something was happening. And, you know, from being in China at that time period, I attended a very large financial conference, you know, almost 2,500 people. I can tell you coronavirus was not discussed. The people.
What date?
So this was like, call it like around January 10th. Uh-huh. You know, not quite the, you know, these were financial professionals. These are, you know, the rich people of China. And they would never have gone to a conference with so many people if they knew something was there. So I think there's a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking that can be done from the China side, from the U.S. side, from any country. If you look at, you know, what's happening in Brazil right now. And to some degree, I think it just shows, you know, why we need high levels of communication and dialogue to try to do a better job the next time to prevent this from having the incredibly negative effects on the U.S. population as well as the U.S. economy.
Okay, so bottom line, then, your take is maybe people are being overly critical of China. Would that be a fair way to sum it up?
I mean, I had thought, you know, being in the New York area, you know, you had a 9/11 commission put together after the fact to go through and say, this is what, you know, how we prevent this from happening. And clearly that 9/11 commission did a very good job, because we've not had a serious incident here in the U.S. And this time around, it looks like we're just going to point the finger over there. There's not going to be any sort of leadership accountability. There's not going to be any reflecting and looking in the mirror. If anything, we seem to want to separate ourselves from the World Health Organization, you know, which was built to try to prevent this sort of situation from occurring. But the bipartisan, it looks like we're just going to point the finger over there and not do any self-reflection. I think that's a very misguided strategy.
So talk to us about the trade negotiations. Not that I don't like it. I don't think it's a trade war. It's a negotiation, you know? So before COVID and after, has it changed? And if so, how?
Well, I think originally the trade war, the art of the deal, was driven by the White House, and now it's become somewhat more bipartisan to try to punish China because of COVID. Certainly the Luckin coffee fraud, which was a terrible, disgraceful, has only exacerbated this kind of frenzy on who can outdo themselves. And I think in some ways the Constitution was written to provide checks and balances to try to keep the kind of madness of crowds from overextending themselves. And to some degree, I think, you know, we're not seeing that happening. You know, ultimately, China is the third largest recipient of U.S. exports. U.S. multinationals doing exceedingly well in China. But none of that has a voice in this current frenzy environment.
Okay, so where do we go from here, though? Are we going to have better relations with China going forward, or are they going to be a Cold War of sorts?
I believe that ultimately the economic relationship is much stronger. And I kind of agree with your point, Jason, that this is a negotiation. And I think there is recognition that going into the election that you want the economy to have a very strong, robust Q3 rebound. And that would be much, much harder to do if you really turn the screws on the trade war, you know, especially in light of the fragile nature of the global and U.S. economy today.
Okay, so that means that Trump is going to play the game with a softer hand?
I think there'll be a lot of bark, but I don't think there'll be as much bite.
Okay.
That I think, you know, again, it's our third largest recipient of U.S. exports.
Right.
And to hurt that or diminish that, you know, would be very, I think, very problematic for the U.S. economy. So,
right. But when you flip that the other way around, we're the largest importer, so we're their biggest customer, right?
For sure. For sure. You know, and that's where, you know, this is, it takes two to tango. I mean, I mean, I think there's a lot of things that China could do, you know, to show some empathy and sympathy for what's happening here, to be a little bit more conciliatory. It takes two to tango. And unfortunately, we're seeing a little bit of the primal human flight or fight or flight instincts. So, you know, I think this is where it's 2020. Like, you know, you pick up the phone, you get on an airplane, you work it out. You know, this is not Sparta versus Athens or Carthage versus Rome. I mean, you know, the means of dialogue and communication have never been more, but it takes both sides. So I'm not being critical of just one side or the other.
Yeah. Well, what do you think about, you seem very diplomatic, maybe too much so. It's a little hard for me to get an answer out of you. I want you to take a side. Come on, man. Give us some sensationalism here.
I guess from an, you know, as an investor, I mean, that's kind of what I'm compensated to do. And, you know, I call it almost, you know, there's ESG investing, and now I kind of call it PESG, where, you know, even investing has become political size.
Sure, yeah.
But as an investor, I mean, we see great growth opportunities in China. I mean, in terms of these Chinese internet and e-commerce names we're invested in, Chinese healthcare has performed exceedingly well. And we've had, you know, knock on wood, we've had some very strong returns in our portfolios. And I think that's where, you know, we love to talk about is, you know, you see these incredible opportunities, these great dynamic companies, and you hate to see that, you know, people are not investing in them because of,
those are Chinese companies. When you say that, that's what you mean, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. Yes. The Alibabas and Tencents. And
so there's been an American capital flight from those companies, or Americans just aren't willing to invest in them as much? Is that what you're saying?
Well, over the last 2 years, the fundamentals of the companies have improved very dramatically. Mm-hmm. And yet the stock prices haven't moved. So one of the things that's happening, Jason, is that the companies are actually relisting in Hong Kong. So in November, Alibaba relisted shares in Hong Kong. And they basically said, you know, U.S. investors, they treat our stock as like it's some sort of China-U.S. trade war proxy. You know, they have nothing to do with the trade war. I mean, the companies, you know, the revenues and for Alibaba have doubled in the last 2 years. Why hasn't the stock? So they went back to Asia where they don't have to explain themselves. And we're seeing NetEase, JD, Baidu, the C-Trip. These companies are all going back and are going to relist in Hong Kong. Those share classes are fungible. We can convert U.S. shares into Hong Kong shares, so we will benefit from that.
Well, let's make sure we talk about Hong Kong. But, you know, to really answer that question that you raised about the stock prices, I mean, you would have to ask the question, compared to what? And does that capital feel that there's better deals on U.S. companies or companies elsewhere? You know, and I don't know, that's such a complicated equation that's way above my pay grade. So I don't know the answer, but I do know the question. Because money always goes where it's treated best. we know that for sure. But I want to make sure we get to Hong Kong and the recent changes there and what that means, because I think that's hugely significant, especially with Pompeo's recent comments about Hong Kong. But first, let's go back to Peter Schiff. I don't know if you know who that is, but maybe you do. He's owns a brokerage company, and he's quite outspoken. He's been on the show before, and you know, he's quick with a soundbite, but often wrong. And years ago, maybe back in 2005 or so, is when I first became aware of this theory that he kept promoting, saying that China is going to create their own middle class. They're going to decouple from the U.S. They won't need us anymore as a customer to buy their exports. And if they don't need us anymore as a customer, they're going to stop buying our treasury bills and our dollar is going to collapse. Obviously, he was gloriously wrong in like every way. I mean, you couldn't have been more wrong than any of those statements, right? But is that ever going to happen? You know, maybe he's just 15 years late. I don't know.
Right.
What do you think?
Well, I do believe, you know, after the global financial crisis, China realized that being export dependent made them very susceptible to downturns. So China's exports as a percentage of GDP's fallen from 35% to 18%. Now that's kind of manufacturing as a percentage of GDP. China resembles the United States, you know, where over half of GDP is from the service sector today. So it has become a much more consumption dependent, despite all the headlines around exports. I mean, obviously exports are very important still, but it has diminished. And I think they do want to move, you know, make themselves less reliant, not just on the United States, this is just in general.
Yeah,
Japan, Europe.
I mean, I don't doubt that. I mean, any country would want that naturally, but can they is another question. I mean, I you know, I guess every country would want that, right? That's not surprising. We want to be less reliant. Everybody wants to be less reliant on a trading partner, but can they do it? I mean, they've got a long way to go. Wages have been going up, but it's not even close to the U.S. in terms of the consumer class, you know?
No, definitely not. I mean, they've made over the last 40 years incredible strides in terms of raising hundreds of millions of people out of poverty and urbanizing in a very dramatic fashion. But certainly there's an element of China is very rich, but there's, you know, broadly speaking, you know, they've got a ways to go. So yeah, I think that's part of, you know, the tactics from the U.S. side is that decoupling from the China side isn't feasible, but I think the same does work in reverse also.
Well, as you see now, the U.S. not wanting to be so dependent for mask, ventilators, other PPE, we've really seen that it's pretty dangerous to have your supply chain dependent on another country. And I think the U.S. has woken up to that, and probably many other countries have too. So do you see a lot of onshoring? I mean, this is all really seems like it's just playing into the Trump narrative. When he was candidate Trump, this was the stuff he was promising. And it seems to all be coming true. And it seems like he's been right, like that he was right about how we need to bring these jobs back into the U.S. We need to bring some of this manufacturing back to the U.S. And he's really championed a lot of this blue collar work and this vocational type work. You know, love him or hate him, it's not a political statement. I'm just saying that was his narrative, and it all seems to be coming true. And, you know, it all seems to have been a valid narrative, too, at the same time, right?
I think, you know, broadly speaking, you know, the factories are over there, not just because of cheap labor, but, you know, there's 4 billion people live in Asia versus under 400 million here. So the factories are there because you can make it inexpensively and then sell to a huge market. You know, if you take India and China combined, right? But throw in the rest of Asia, it's 4 billion people. So the factories are there for a reason. And part of that is, you know, again, to make things inexpensively, but second is to sell it to the local market. So I think in terms of the healthcare, I mean, that is a sector that we do like, not just China healthcare, but EM healthcare. You know, self-serving and highly biased. I mean, we have investments in both of those and sector funds on both of those segments, and they've performed exceedingly well for obvious reasons. I think ultimately, you know, there's 13 million Americans work in manufacturing versus 100 million Chinese in manufacturing. So, you know, this idea of you're going to bring the jobs back, every American would have to go work in a factory.
Well, you don't need to bring that many jobs back. You just need to. It's proportionate to the size of the American population. So if you have 150 million adults in the labor force in America, roughly, and you got 327 million people, then it's just a percentage equation, right? I mean, there's obviously a lot of people out of work, especially now. A few million manufacturing jobs wouldn't hurt anybody, right?
Well, it's almost like, why does U.S. farming need migrant labor?
Well, didn't before. I mean, it's only been because Americans got rich and spoiled and didn't want to pick strawberries, or at least not at the wages being offered. And so the immigrants came in and undercut the market, and hey, capitalism works great. You know, everybody just goes for the best deal. And so why wouldn't they hire the low cost immigrants, right? They just won't pay American wages for those types of jobs because the employers have been spoiled too.
Yeah, no, I agree 100% that, you know, some element of just labor costs are so inexpensive. And it's not even, you know, China has gotten richer. So the real low labor in Asia today is Malaysia.
Right.
Indonesia, you really want to go down, you know, clothing, you know, Bangladesh. Mm-hmm. So to some degree, I agree that I think, you know, some element is these manufacturing jobs in a lot of cases are very, very low skill set. And you can't replace that here. Just as picking strawberries, you got to bring people up from Latin America to do it because Americans won't do it, you know, for a certain. So I would, you know, I think some element does come back. I think, you know, we have a strategic petroleum reserve. Having a strategic healthcare reserve makes a world of sense to me.
Yeah.
But to say we're going to force something back here for something that happens. It's happened once in 100 years. I mean, what's the irony is, like, after SARS in 2009, or I'm sorry, H1N1 in 2009, you know, they actually built a stockpile and they just let it go. They never replenished it. You know, the government had this stuff and didn't replenish it, but the local factories, they can't exist unless you want to subsidize it. You know, do you want a state-owned enterprise? You know, an American state-owned enterprise, you know, that opens up a whole nother realm.
It's a whole nother discussion, of course. Yeah. Okay. Well, what else do you want people to know?
So on Hong Kong, I mean, obviously a beautiful city. I mean, I'll hopefully be able to visit again soon. But no, I think my take on their view, you know, you kind of hear our view on Hong Kong. To some degree, I think a lot of the local business has been disrupted by the local protests. Really, tourism has stopped, not just in Hong Kong and Macau. So, I think this bill was an attempt to try to obviously tighten the security from the perspective of, you know, these protests have had a adverse effect on the local economy. But obviously, if you extrapolate out, you know, where that law could be applied, it makes, you know, obviously it makes a lot of people very, very nervous. You know, from the China side, you know, they knew what they were doing. So, you know, for us, it's more of the local Hong Kong economy has really suffered for really the last 2 years, you know, well before going into the coronavirus.
Right.
Obviously,
but everybody's already forgotten about the civil unrest there and the protests and, you know, everything mm-hmm. that was going on. That just shut down immediately with Corona.
For sure.
That was pretty convenient for the government. But now China has really exerted their authority over Hong Kong rather than treating it as this sort of loose region like they were and being a little bit laissez-faire about it. So things are changing, and I see a mass exodus out of Hong Kong. I see a mass exodus out of cities in general because of the virus fears. I mean, certainly New York, where your office is, that things are changing. But then you take China and they're exerting more control over things. I mean, people are going to want to leave and money will flee as much as possible. Of course, there are capital controls, but
yeah, I mean, certainly we know Singapore and Tokyo are actively lobbying the financial community to relocate. And so it's hard to say, you know, Hong Kong has, you know, for expats, and it's a beautiful place to live. My view is Hong Kong has an underlying issue, which is income and housing inequality or housing affordability, that you've got, you know, 7.5 million people in a very, very small space. You know, apartments tend to be quite small. Because of so many people, there's no wage growth, there's no job security. So Hong Kong, for the expats, it's a great place to be. I think it's a very difficult place for a lot of the locals. You know, we kind of fly in, go to nice hotels and office
buildings.
It's
like going to Dubai, same idea, you know, they've got slave labor. And, you know, all the whole thing. Yeah, and people live in mostly crappy conditions, except for the rich, you know. Yeah. Okay. Well, what else do you want people to know? And let's wrap it up. Give out your website.
Yeah. So craneshares.com is our website where we list our exchange traded funds. We provide a daily blog on called ChinaLastNight.com. So just an overview of what happened last night in China in terms of economics, stock markets. But certainly, yeah, we know, I mean, stepping back, we just had MSCI semi-annual index rebalance.
What is China's MSCI? Now, what is MSCI?
So MSCI is the big index provider for a lot of index funds and ETFs. So they refresh their index kind of twice a year. For emerging markets, now China is just about 42% of the weight, but it's numerically, it's over 700. It's more than 50% of the stocks in emerging markets. So ultimately, you know, China, as the trade war proved, China is an important trade partner, and we believe we want to provide a balanced perspective on what's happening there.
Good to know. Well, Brendan, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge about this very important market and the relationships between the countries and the world. And we appreciate having you on.
No, thank you very much, Jason.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guest opinions are their own, and if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.